Welcome to Bold Talk Radio. I'm your host, Pat Williams, and thank you guys so much for tuning in for today's episode. This is part two to our five-part series with book author Robert A. St. Thomas, and this is a discussion on his new book, Riddle of Oz. And so with that being said, Robert, thank you so much for joining us again for part two of this series.
Thank you for having me. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to send this message out to your listeners, and I hope it bears fruit. Hope it helps them look at the situation we call life a little bit differently. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Awesome. Robert, well, thank you. Listen, that first episode, I would invite anybody, I'm not just saying it to be saying it or to, you know, blow smoke or, you know, toot my own horn, but the first episode was phenomenal. Robert did an amazing job just kind of laying out some of the groundwork of the book. And we got into some pretty hot little topics, didn't we, Robert?
Yeah, we did.
I'm hoping somebody won't come after you and be wanting to spank you a little bit. Y'all gotta, don't mess with my boy Robert. Robert is, did a phenomenal job. But we got into some really deep stuff. You got him on standby.
I got him on standby.
Robert, look, man, listen, we're not going to let nothing happen to you. You're in good hands. But no, I'm saying that to jest, and people will get a chance to listen to the first episode. I think that they will be intrigued and fascinated, and I think they will be provoked. I mean, I don't think, you know, which is the purpose of this show, Bold Talk Radio. I believe in, and sometimes we have to be provoked. And I don't mean that in a negative way. People only think provocation is negative, but sometimes we can be provoked unto positivity. Wouldn't you agree, Robert?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Awesome. Awesome. Exactly. And I think that's what your book is doing, Robert. I believe that your book, Riddle of Oz, I believe it may provoke somebody, maybe in the negative way. There's always that. But I believe that it definitely will provoke people to a very positive understanding. And with that being said, one of the things that came out in our first discussion, I asked you very plainly who the book was for. And you gave us a very beautiful detailing that you really wrote this book in part with mostly men in mind. Anybody can read your book. So ladies, don't feel that you can't. Don't feel that you won't enjoy it. I'm a lady. Last time I checked in the washroom. Okay, in this day and time, you can never know. But I think anyone would feel just welcome and be able to get the gist of your book. So, Robert, with that being said and done, let's get into the book. Actually, one of the things that I noticed that you did is that you broke this book down in different phases. And that's the exact terminology you used. You used phase one, phase two, phase three, so on and so forth. But how you did that in the book, you kind of centered in on using the phases almost as the seven deadly sins. I mean, you have phase five, which is greed, and you have, you know, phase seven, which is envy. Why did you take that approach?
Yeah, I wanted to show again that human nature can be swayed by basically 40 psychology. Ego, super ego type thing. And
now, can you explain that, Robert, just for our audience who may not know what you mean by that terminology?
Thank you. I was going to use a second for that. Just really basic psychology. Sigmund Freud came up with a model to explain the psyche of people, basically things that explains human nature. So he came up with three components of the psyche. One of them called your id. Your id is just think of the basement of a house. And this is where, you know, we have a primitive natural drive. Nothing wrong with it. Primitive natural drive. Instinctive. We're all born with it. Characteristics of an id is that it seeks pleasure. It seeks pleasure. That's its thing. It seeks pleasure. It's impulsive. It's part of the component that Jesus would say, spirit is willing, but flesh is weak. Flesh, in this particular case, is making synonymous with the end. It's instinctive, impulsive, no morality, interest is only in immediate gratification. That's it. Ego state is like your living room, okay? Or your, I guess when I was a kid, your upstairs room or whatever. But anyway, your ego, you have to put it in the terms of being your reality person, It tries to stay in reality. It also likes pleasure. But its primary role is to find a way of satisfying its desire for pleasure. The ego likes pleasure, but it finds a role to have the id experience pleasure. So you might say that a normal ego would be a moderator to the id, whereas a disruptive or corrupted ego would become an enabler to the, in other words, there won't be like a governor, it'll continue to feed the desire for pleasure. Quick analogy, if you saw this movie, Little House of Horrors, you recall there was a plant would cry out to the sky, feed me, feed me, feed me. They would do so, and if you saw it in the movie, mm-hmm. the plant became bigger and bigger and bigger. So sort of a symbolic idea of what's going on with the id and the ego. The guy that was feeding this plant would be your enabler. Feeding this thing, letting it become more voracious, insatiable, and getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it got out of control. Your third component is your superego. Your superego is the seat of all your morality. That's why we go to church. We have morals. We believe in things like right and wrong. Different about superego over the ego and the id is that this is the seat of learned behavior. So our morals and our ways that we to deal with people, this has to be learned. It's not innate. It's not innate. Because the Bible says man is wicked. The only way we can sort of correct that wickedness is by seeking something outside of us, that makes us better people, good people. So your superego, again, is the thing that really modulates the id. I mean, it will not let this thing get out of check, okay? So having a strong superego, you know, keeps intact the function of the ego, and more importantly, will not allow the id to get out of control, okay? That's just really a basis. And as we go along, we can explain a little bit more so that people get a better idea of what's going on. This is the key thing. Remember, superego, you have to, this is the seat of learned behavior. If you're not born with it, learned it. Things that are passed out by your parent, grandparent, school teachers, police officers, whatever. These are learned behaviors. Ego is something you're born with, but it's there to sort of protect the body and feed the id. The id, think again, is the basement. This is where you can, your most primitive instinct resides. Your sex drive, your hunger drive, the drive to survive, so on and so forth. Okay, so our discussion tonight, I think you'll be leading tonight, we're going to sort of reveal how this id has gotten out of control. Mm-hmm. Okay? But the normal balance that should be there, you're going to see how these masterminds have basically disrupted this balance that should be there, which has caused changes in human behavior.
Got it. Now, listen, Robert, thank you for laying that out, because let's go right into it. One of the things I was looking at, mentioning how you broke it down, the book and the prologue, you broke this thing down to different phases. And as I said, which I thought was very brilliant and very genius, to be honest with you, you broke it down by the seven deadly sins. But I want to go to one very specifically, because it ties right into the previous episode's discussion And I think anybody who listened to that would be able to easily catch on to where we're picking up here. But even if they haven't listened to the first part, I would encourage them to do so, but they could still get it from here. In phase six, you have here sloth, and I'm going to go right to it, and I'm going to read that for the audience. It says, the era of pop culture and decadence, the rise of mass communication with the spread of knowledge and fall of wisdom, mass immigration and pandering to those immigrants by certain politicians, Hollywood, movie celebrities, set the stage for, quote, Star Wars. Using boiling water as an analogy, social tensions are at a boiling point where small pinhead bubbles are now appearing. In America, women are no longer viewed as loving hearts in the home, but cold-blooded assassins with a license, and you have in parentheses here, rights, to murder the most helpless and innocent. Police are no longer respected as authority figures, but public perception views them as executioners with a license to kill. Everything is going to plan as American society is slowly unraveling, end quote. Now, Robert, that's a whole heck of a lot of mashed potatoes on that plate. Let's just start unpacking that, because just that right there, I mean, you're dealing with a mouthful. Pick us up, because where we left off, we were talking about progression to regression, and we got into some of the pop culture stuff of it, of the Hollywood, and you mentioned about Star Wars. So let's first delve into that part here as you're dealing with in phase six of sloth.
Yeah. I do mention in the book that had America not capitulated to the Beatles and to the British invasion and pop culture, we would have had essentially a World War III in the 70s. We would have had World War III in the 70s. But what happened is because Americans had capitulated or surrendered to this influence that fed the end, America basically took on the persona of their enemy, okay? And in this particular case, the enemy is communism.
Mm-hmm.
But the readers may not have heard, one of the inspirations for writing the book was, I always wondered why would communism not go away, considering it's a system that everybody knows it failed. Unless, you know, the only reason why it stays around is force bomb on individuals. But
now, Robert, let me stop you right there. Let me stop you cold, because I can hear people in our audience who are listening to this say, what is this guy talking about? Of course, communism is over. The Cold War is ended. The Berlin Wall came down. There's no more, you know, superpowers like that. How do you address them in what you're, you know, kind of perpetuating and capitulating in your book?
Exactly. Again, you see, what has happened is that in 1933, a revolution that has not been detected has been going on in this country since 1933. The object is to destroy America from within. The Berlin Wall is symbolic. It's interesting. This day of age where, you know, many Americans are upset at President Trump wanting to build the wall to keep immigrants out. But actually, when the Soviets put that wall up in Berlin, it was actually to do the same thing. The wall went up to stop the influence of Western civilization from entering into the East, or with the Soviets. Okay? That's what the wall. So the Soviets said, right, I'm keeping something out that may change the mindset of the people that they were in control. But the Berlin Wall fell, not because of something Ronald Reagan said. The Berlin Wall fell because the West started taking on the characteristics of the people of the East. So it fell not because of some diplomatic victory, you know, by our politicians in the West. It fell because the American people began to adopt the ways and personality of what communism was offering the world in the first place. Okay, so so itself, because we capitulated to the pressure from the East rather than the East, rather than the West changing the mind of the communists. Communism hasn't gone away. Communism hasn't gone away. It just morphed into different forms. It morphed into interest groups, okay?
So are you saying, so Robert, are you saying then that because you know, coming from your position and your viewpoint here, you're saying communism never went away. All it did was kind of lay low a little bit, change its hat, change its underwear, and now it's still on the scene, but it's actually moving sort of as this microorganism through other aspects of society, which, as we could point out, you're mentioning pop culture. Am I correct in my determination of that?
You nailed it. You nailed it. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Because I'll tell you that the manifestation of this absolutely brilliant plan by these masterminds, we saw the 60s with the Beatles showing up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Beatles were a group that basically started the softening up process, or you might say accelerating the process, where Americans would start to reject their tradition, Christian tradition, fathers being head of the family, you know, basic American things. We also began to see a shift in the 60s, where we were shifting from becoming a more patriarchal society into a matriarchal society. Okay.
But now, Robert, I hate to keep interrupting you because you're saying so many fantastical things. I have to. OK, so now let's look at the Beatles, because you're mentioning this and you do use them as a kind of a, you know, showing how that shift took place, that paradigm shift. Let me just address it straight out. You may have some Beatle fans out here and say, wait a minute, is this guy serious? I mean, is he really saying that the Beatles, the little Beatles, John, Paul, Ringo, and George, that these four guys who just seem like the most innocent guys in the world making these cutesy little pop, British pop songs, I wanna hold your hand. Is he saying that these guys are responsible for the downslope, the moral decline of America? What would you say to that?
I would say that that's probably pretty accurate. That's pretty accurate. You recall the Beatles. Paul said, I have never could figure out what made these guys so popular. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
But if you had a television screen in here, you put down the middle, and you put the Beatles on the left performing, and you put, let's say, think again in the 1959 terms, you put, say, Tom Jones or James Brown or Elvis Presley mm-hmm. on the other side of the screen, I would tell you that 99, 44, 100% of the eyes would look to the right, and they would look at Elvis, James Brown, or Tom Jones.
Mm-hmm.
So he demonstrated that stage presence, they had sexuality, and they just had what it was that captured the eyes of an individual. You look at the Beatles and you're looking at four guys that basically had nothing going for them. They played guitars. You never saw them gyrate their hips like Elvis did or Tom Jones. They didn't have the dynamic stage presence of a James Brown. So what made these guys considering that six, 7 months ago, Quincy Jones didn't have much complimentary things to say about it at all. You know, he thought that they were average musicians that could even tune their guitars, if I remember a quote that he said. Now, granted, Quincy's in his 80s and folks may think he's losing something, but this is a man that has, like, what, almost 30 Grammys to his name. He's written television scores, movie scores. So this man must know.
He's iconic. He's absolutely iconic. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he's saying something. He can look back and hide and say, oh, these guys won't listen about anything. And if you listen to their music most of the musicians I've talked to thought that these guys were average. Now, I mean, they go as the most popular group of all time, but it seems to have happened by accident. Because they were struggling musicians. They changed the name. They lost one band member. They replaced one drummer. Pete Best and Ringo Starr, and then apparently met someone who told them the formula to writing music that would capture an audience fancy, and that's basically what got them going. But by accident, these guys became megastars, you know, by accident. But they were part of that. They were part of that agenda, softening Americans up, especially American youth, to start rejecting traditional American values and start to embrace, you know, like the pop culture, tune in, tune out, wearing your hair like Jesus, rebelling against mom and dad, and there were no moral absolutes. They basically set the stage for that phase that you were talking about with Flock, you know, and decadence. Okay, so as society was changing from a more patriarchal society, you could say that Pandora's box was really opened, and just about everything that you think of came out, and we've seen manifestations of it since the 60s, and that's what I'm saying as far as what was behind that, of course, was the communist ideology, which is anti-Western and anti-Christian.
Okay, now, Robert, let me intervene on this, because here's what I want to make sure that we're very clear on for our audience sake. Because it sounds to me what you're saying, if I can kind of parse it together, is that let's use the Beatles because you use that, that these guys started out, you know, like I said, very clean cut. I mean, there's no debate. I'm sure you'll get the debate whether how good they were or weren't. Of course, Quincy Jones made recent statements on that. But we're not really here to debate or discuss, you know, what their acumen was in terms of, you know, musicianship. But what it sounds like you're saying to me, on the grander scope of things, is that you had these guys, the Beatles, right? And these guys who were just kind of going nowhere fast in Liverpool, right? England. And
right.
Here's a, for lack of a better term on my part, but here's this systemic or this system, this machine, if you will, who says, listen, let's kind of take these guys, let's get them kind of prepped and primed a little bit to be an image of something new, something clean cut, something very nice, something that would attract, you know, young people and as well as older people. And then through the realm of pop culture, through that vehicle, begin to maybe present, if not full out, promote different messaging and different ideology to a younger generation. Am I getting that all summed up correct? Is why what you're saying here about the Beatles and about pop culture and celebrity?
Yeah, you got that right. You got that right. And you probably also want to say that the Beatles was probably one of the greatest social experiments unleashed upon mankind of all time. And again, the influence of Western civilization was actually eroded away by the successful rock group called the Beatles. I'm saying that they're one of the most successful social experiments ever unleashed upon mankind.
Well, who was conducting the social experiment, Robert? Because I think that's what the audience really want to know. It's like, okay, is this, there's this shadow, you know, spooky government, like the man behind the curtain, which is, you know, I'm referring to the title of your book now, right? The little guy behind the curtain who's, you know, controlling all the marionettes. Who conducted that experiment?
Yeah, that's an analogy. That's a very excellent analogy. If you remember, Oz was the guy that was running, or a man that basically had the spook that he was all powerful, omnipotent, you know, Jesus-like, you know. And basically what he did is he basically kept the people of the Emerald City, where he was located, he basically kept them happy, so to speak. I mean, you know, he distracted them with goodies and hopes and, you know, probably, you know, he had, if you probably had things like entitlement programs or whatever, he kept them happy and controlled that way. But
So satisfying that pleasure principle, that id, right? Because we're going to tie it into Freudian thought. So you're saying that there's this thing, you know, where society itself, you mentioned the ego, the id, the ego, and the superego. And if I understand, you know, I took, you know, college and I understood, you know, reading about Freud myself, but understanding those terms and tying it back into your book and what we're discussing tonight, it sounds as if what you're saying is through the realm of communism, that mechanism, that there are individuals who, like you say, through the goodies, you know, through the goodies of society, through the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, man, you know, make love, not make love and peace, not war kind of thing, that by satisfying that id and that pleasure principle, that this is the way that socialism and the cousin, the more evil cousin of socialism, that that communism can survive and not only survive, but thrive. Is that what you're trying to tell us tonight?
That's why I never want to wait. That's why I never want to wait, because it keeps appealing to the id in every generation, especially the younger generation. The younger generation that, when I was kids coming up, kids, I'm sure, had sex and did all the things that people do now, but it was not at the extremes that we see now. I mean, you don't really see people, sure, people get married now, but the thing nowadays is to, you know, shack up and, you know, test drive the car for about 5 years, make sure that, you know, you want to, you know, that kind of stuff. You'll drink. Drinking the milk to make sure that it's not foul. You know, any kind of reason to not commit yourself to the other individual. They always want this out. You know, like she didn't the breakdown of the family when she didn't cook my meal this way, or she didn't have sex with me, or blah blah anything. If my kid is not satisfied, I'm out of here. I'm on to move on to something else. Who is going to satisfy my ears? Okay, that's what it is. So communism has played on that. And remember, how it works is that after World War One, these communist intellectuals were wondering, how can the whole world have to become communist? I mean, we're offering them things like equality, sex, drugs, mobile relativism. Why didn't it take off? Well, it didn't take off because It was a principle forced on people. It was forced on people. And deep down, no one really likes to covet another man's property, wife, and car. They don't really know. So it sort of backs off. And the reason why it backs off is that, again, most Europeans were raised Christian. Okay, ever since the Roman Empire decided to go all Catholic, the Europeans were raised Christian with the strong superego, basically governing their head, okay? So you had a guy named Antonio Gramsci, who we don't talk about much, who basically said, hey, wait a minute, the way to finally get our way is we got to get rid of basically two things to knock down barriers to communism. We need to get rid of Christianity, and we need to get rid of America. Okay, that's the most unique country. We get rid of this, we get rid of America, then Christianity will fall and it will get our way. Okay? So he theorized this term called the long march through the culture, Antonio Gramsci. The long march through the culture. Meaning that we are going to attack America, not up close, but from a distance. We're not going to try to win this war with bloodshed. What we're going to do is do like the great heroes of the past, Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan. Okay, these people won their wars basically with psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
Get your mind, and have you basically capitulate to us this way. The Soviets had the atomic bomb, the United States had the atomic bomb. Wouldn't do anybody any good if somebody let this thing drop the bomb and the whole world is irradiated. It ain't doing anybody any good. But if we can influence them in a manner that is so desirable to it, then we'll have it eating out of our hands. Okay? This goes back to what I was saying about the Berlin Wall. The Berlin Wall was put up by the Soviets to keep the influence of Christianity from coming back into the East. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the Berlin Wall was put up. Okay? But the Berlin Wall dropped when American or Western civilization, like the people in France or England, they started taking on the characteristics, the liberal characteristics of the communists. But they said, no, it comes shooting. It ain't out of my hands now. And we just keep this up decade by decade, and by the time, before you know it, without firing a shot, these people don't be communists. That's what their strategy was, okay? So that's what we're talking about, how these brilliant behavioral sciences starting in as early as 1919, started these experiments to see if they could control people. Crowd control is what it's called, by basically feeding their id and basically corrupting the super ego. And they did they've done an excellent point. At this point, I would say that they are winning this cultural war that they basically started in 1990. They're basically winning it.
Almost 100 years, Robert, it sounds like. Let me...
That's the plan.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's their plan. Started in 1933, and their plan was by 2033 that America, would basically be a communist country. America, as we can... And we can see it now. We can see it now with people attacking the First Amendment, Second Amendment, Christianity, the father, the family, it goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
That we are situated to the thinking of these people who haven't gone away, and they're relentless with their belief that we are, well, what's the Khrushchev bitch? We're going to bury you. And we thought that the cat was talking about dropping their atomic bomb and all that, but they distracted us from the you know, using a football analogy, you know, they basically used the backdoor play on America. Okay, they weren't coming up the middle. They basically did an end-around play, and that's basically how they got putting into America that they have right now.
I see. Now, Robert, let's talk a little bit about it, because you use this term, and I've heard this term, and actually, if I must ascribe this term, I think it was former Fox News personality Bill O'Reilly, who I used to watch The O'Reilly Factor when it was on. It was kind of a shame that he lost his show, because I found myself not agreeing with a lot of what he said or his political views, but I found myself really relating to some of the overall premise of what O'Reilly used to pinpoint. And one of the terms he used was the cultural wars. He used to actually have a segment on that show, and anyone who's listening who have had an opportunity to watch The O'Reilly Factors, or there may be older episodes you can find maybe on YouTube or online somewhere, but he had a segment on that show which was just dedicated to that and to that terminology, cultural wars. So if I'm hearing you correctly, Robert, it sounds to me that you believe that O'Reilly wasn't too far off the mark in understanding that America is at a cultural war. Do you really believe that?
Yeah, and that's probably the reason why Bill is off the air, is because, again, when somebody speaks the truth, he basically becomes a villain. And in this day and age, a villain is basically, they come after him.
I told you, we're not going to let anybody bother you, Robert. You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
I told you, I got a witness protection program on standby. So,
that's right.
But what had happened, again, very quickly, communism, as you know, was an economic-based system where we wanted to play one against the other by saying, this guy has more money or more wealth than you, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so he had this so-called advocate for justice, go to these people that he labeled proletariat. These are the victims that say, hey, look, you're suffering, you got all these things going, and, you know, these people, you know, eat silly mignon, they're riding around the best carriages, they live in the best castle. You need to stop this, and you're doing all the work, and you're doing all the things, and it's just benefiting us. If we redistribute this wealth, then get rid of these people, the bourgeois people, then everybody would be happy. We could usher the utopian society and everybody will live happily ever after, okay? But as I said, it didn't work, okay? Because there's something inherent about it. There's a law in our hearts. And then we're really not supposed to covet about with somebody. We're really not supposed to steal. We're not supposed to slander. We're not supposed to do those things. And why communism in the classic sense failed. Okay, so Gramsci and these guys sit back and say, wait a minute, okay, we want this thing to work and it should work, but what we need is new proletariat. We need more victims. Okay, where are we going to get these victims from? It's okay, I have no problem. Mm-hmm. We then will, people who are holding on to things in their head, and we'll make those our new proletariat. For instance, new proletariat would be people like gay, lesbian, transgender,
LGBTQ.
Yes, students, angry black people, militant black people. Okay, these are the new proletariat.
Okay, Robert, I got to jump in on that. You know I do. Because, okay, so what you're saying is, because I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want you to clarify and correct me if I'm wrong. So what you're saying is that this evolution of communism, right, and the powers that be that delve into that are saying, okay, the new proletariats will be, let's just sum it up, would be groups that have been maligned. I mean, whether you're black, whether you're immigrant, whether you're, you know, Hispanic, whether you're even woman or LGBTQ, what you're saying is these would have been what people would consider historically maligned or discriminated groups, that these would be the new proletariats. Am I hearing you correct?
That's correct. Those are the new proletariats.
But why? Why these groups? Why these groups?
Well, these groups are always considered the marginal people of society, looked down upon. Certainly, God has had historical issues with, you know, certain sexually oriented groups. So this is a way of, remember, communism, the smokescreen was, it's an economic thing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That was the smokescreen. There was no rally against the bourgeois because they have wealth and power. And so we get rid of them, but underneath, the person with the target on the back of these people is God, okay? And if you get rid of God, then we can have a society that basically is godless, but you will worship me as men, okay? But with these new proletariat, the same thing, it's the same motive, okay? But the person that they really want to go after is to get rid of God, specifically Jesus, if they can, because then these folks will not have, say, like, guilt complexes about, say, relationships, same-sex relationships, or same-sex marriage. If you get rid of God, then you can take away that collective consciousness that communists want to destroy. Remember, the collective consciousness we're talking about is that superego.
Yes, but how does it, but Robert, now wait a minute, before we get too far along in that, how then would that though tie into, because I do want to get into some other parts of just, we're dealing with these different phases, but then how would that, because let me back up and make a clarification for the audience who are listening. If I'm taking your premise, right, and you're saying, okay, let's get rid of Jesus. Let's get rid of the Bible. Let's get rid of Christ. Let's get rid of the church. Let's get rid of all that, right? So people can, you know, live in this utopia of superego, right? Which leads to hedonism and everybody just kind of do your thing and nobody says nothing about it, right? Okay, so from that perspective, that would make sense to me how it could be where the LGBTQ community could be manipulated into being that new proletariat, right? But what doesn't make sense to me is how then would the superego, right? How would that premise tie into, let's say, a poor guy from, I don't know, Jalisco, Mexico, or from Guatemala somewhere, who's just trying to find a better life for he and his wife and his kids coming to America. Yes, maybe illegal, but he just wants to find a better life here. Or let's say a black guy who's like, look, man, I'm just trying to find a better job because I don't want to go the way of statistics or the way of the stereotype of, you know, out here hustling. How then would that premise tie into those guys?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. I remember people the prevailing attitude nowadays that this is a person because they're coming for a better life, okay? And you should deny it because this is a nation of immigrants. Well, no, it's a nation of a specific superego that makes up America, okay? It's a nation of a specific superego, meaning that there's a plan behind what these citizens are about. The plan of the citizens are to, you could say, live a godly life, following the principles of Jesus, and that what our mission is to make sure that everybody goes to heaven when we die.
Now, wait, okay? You're saying that this is the premise of the foundational structure of America?
Yeah.
But how so, Robert? Because I know we said we would get into that. How so? And before you answer it, because I mean you're oh gosh, this is really getting good. How so? In the sense of, I've had so many friends of mine who come from all walks of life, and even my own thoughts. But I'll put that aside for now. If you look at the Constitution, right, and you look at the founding fathers, and one thing that constantly comes up in every debate I've been into, I've always heard at least one person at any given time say, well, okay, Pat, listen, if the argument is that America and the founding fathers wanted America to be a Christian nation, why, when it really came down to putting the pedal to the metal and pen to parchment, why was it that when these guys could have nailed it down, etched it in stone in the Constitution to say, listen, our God for this nation will be the Christian God, will be the God of Israel, will be Jesus Christ. All the principles of the Bible, it will be how we will operate and move this government. When it came down to it, when you look at the Constitution is very clear that government would make no law in respect of any religion or divinity. So how do you square those two, you know, kind of warring ideas there?
Yeah. Well, we have to look at this. Remember, where did the people come from that founded this Protestant-based country? Came from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
As we said before, really only two types of religions in all of Europe. You're either Catholic or you're a Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
You're a Christian, but you're either Catholic or Protestant. Okay, when the people came to this country, they weren't leaving Jesus behind. Okay, they in fact they brought him over. Okay? The issue was, how do we serve Jesus? Okay, because remember, this was a Protestant-based country founded. Okay, Catholics came over, and basically, you know, you could even double check this out with like the Magna Carta thing. The Mayflower Compact.
Mm-hmm.
Folks were saying, okay, you know, you're our kindred. You're our blood. We're Caucasian people. We look alike. But we have something different. We have different religious beliefs. So remember, the Protestant thought that Catholicism was a different religion. It was like a paganized form of Christianity. Okay, so they saw it as a different religion where, you know, you're Protestant. We're pure people here. We're practicing Christianity the way they want to. Okay, but these were people that were kindred to them. I mean, these were Anglo-Saxon people. Okay, descendants from Isaac's sons and all this kind of stuff. Okay, so when you come over here, fellas, we don't want no trouble. Okay, we don't want the stuff that happened with the Inquisition. Okay, where you were taking people away and putting them in jail or torturing them because you wouldn't honor them. We don't want that stuff here. They compromised. That First Amendment about, you know, no religion should, you know, potentially dominate over another. So Protestant Catholic issue saying that I will respect your folks and you will respect my king. But the guy that we basically are worshiping Jesus. Okay.
Yeah, let me just go to the real heart of that though. But and I hear what you're saying. There was a course that diametric opposition between the Catholics and the Protestants and the Puritans and that sort of stuff. But just hear me out, is that once you etch it in writing in the Constitution to say that government will make no law in respect to any religion, then doesn't that in of itself open the the door to different ideologies such as secularism, such as even socialism and communism.
No, no.
Why not?
No. Who's government? Is government a building? Is government office in Washington, D.C.? Is government the Lincoln Memorial? Government is people.
We the people. Right. But we the people are different people. Some of us are atheists. Some of us are agnostics.
Even as a black person, it took me a while to understand what those people were trying to say. Because when I came up to school, I just knew that the founding fathers were going to start this kind of utopian society, because the word free was used so ubiquitously when I was coming. Everything free, free, free. And, you know, as a kid coming up, oh, a free country means, well, you're free to do anything. That's not what those people meant. That's not what those people meant. If you were breaking down what they meant by being free, meant that you were free to keep what you earned from a guy like Henry VIII or some sort of tyrant in England. They didn't leave the mortality behind.
Now, wait a minute, though, Robert. And I hear that. But now when you look at other parts, and I think this may be the preamble, I'm no constitutional expert. But when you get to even parts in the Constitution where it says, that every man is endowed by his creator, right, to certain inalienable rights, which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I think the bigger question is the pursuit of happiness, because here's why. Robert, your pursuit of happiness may not be mine. My pursuit of happiness may be, guess what? I just want to go to church. I want to praise the Lord, and I want to, you know, do what's right. But this other guy's pursuit of happiness may be he wants to go and lay with five women and have 10 kids.
This is why the founding fathers were not multiculturalist.
But is it because their society at that time, think about it, because Robert, I hear what you're saying, but think about it. If we go back to the 1700s versus 2000, almost 2019, as of this recording, think about it. The type of America they had, there were not Muslims or atheists, or at least not openly LGBTQIA. It was none of that there. Black people were, you know, basically slaves, the Indian people. So it was a different type of landscape. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Well, you know, remember, most of the people that came to this country in the beginning came as entrepreneurs. They didn't come as of religious persecution. That happened a little bit later, but most of the people came for entrepreneurship. They wanted to live like the royals if they could do so. They wanted to live like the royals, and in the beginning you had many people who did live like the royals, and that's what basically fostered slavery on.
Mm-hmm.
When they realized that they were slaves to the Bank of England, I believe they sat down and realized, this stuff is going to fall apart. What kind of system can we put in place where we can perpetuate this society that it could last forever? And I do believe this is where they looked at the models that had already been used, with the Magna Carta, where the king basically was running things, Mayflower Compact, where we basically let people run things, and they saw the flaws and said, wait a minute, the only way we can truly live in peace and promote happiness for our world, you left out, if you go over the preamble, prosperity. They felt that all laws would have to come from God, because from God, a man's rights could not be taken away from him, okay? So we're talking about government, okay? If you give your laws to government, then government, okay, can take the laws away. So they didn't want it. They wanted something like God, something that's eternal, just, fair, and unchanging. This is why they said all those inalienable rights would represent the rights of the citizens of the United States, okay? So there was no room for a competing religious philosophy who would tell an American citizen there are different ways to get back to come out. And those people didn't believe that at all.
Right, but Robert, it couldn't just be, and I hear what you're saying, but I'm really kind of putting some of this out there too, because I can only imagine what the audiences are thinking. So I have to kind of present from their angle and their viewpoint. But could it just be, though, that again, if I'm in a setting where I'll give you the perfect example. If I'm in a setting where it's just only black people, and we're only black people that believe in Jesus, and we start something, then of course, with my limited situation, I would write something that obviously could would speak to that time. But if I'm not in a setting, you know what I mean, where maybe 200 years down the line, maybe everybody now is Chinese and Indian. And so do you understand what I'm saying? Could it have been that the constitutionalists, the writers, the founding fathers were only looking through just this linear kind of telescope through of where they were at that time? And I think, if you don't mind me saying, I think that's probably why they kind of left some loose ends in the Constitution, which is what I go back to the debate. I've heard people debate me and say, well, Pat, if the founding fathers and the constitutionalists, if these guys really loved Jesus so great, they could have just put it in stone and said, look, everybody serve Jesus Christ. And we don't care if you're straight, gay, black or white. This is the God of this land. And if you don't like it, get out of Dodge. But they didn't tie it down like that. Why?
Well, In a way, they did, because everybody that was in this country who settled it was Christian.
Yeah, but they didn't really tie it down, Robert, because they left it open saying, well...
Read the preamble again, especially the part when you're, like you say, when they promote general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. That's more people overlook. Well, who's the posterity? Posterity means your generation. It means your generation, okay? Now, I have no problem believing that the founders had a segregated mindset at the outset. I have no problem with that. Because, again, they believed in one particular faith principle, and they felt that, remember, even though it was like the 18th century, 17th century, 16th century. These people knew about history. I mean, they knew about the fall of the Roman Empire. They knew about the fall of the Greek Empire. They knew about the fall of the Egyptian. They knew that the common thread for those empires falling is when they basically began to embrace multiculturalism.
Okay.
Not so much multiracialism, but multiculturalism, where I believe this way, no, I think this is my way, no, we believe this way, and that. This is what caused the decay and the destruction of those societies. So I have no problem with the founders setting up initially a restricted, segregated country until you bought into our way of thinking. Then you became part of the posterity. But they didn't want isolated groups of people in the country. They ultimately would grow in power. They had different ways of thinking. And they would want a better deal for their own particular group, okay? And the own particular group would then ultimately push out people to basically establish the country in the first place. Isn't that what's happening in Europe? Christian-based country. Now I hear people don't even go to these beautiful churches in England and France. Okay, there's mosques popping up all over the place, okay? Because this group that has come in now is now going to supersede the group that set up the situation in the first place, okay? So the founders, you could be part of the posterity if you bought into basically
American ideal. But see, Robert, and listen, because we were wrapping up, we've got about 7 minutes left. We will come back to this in episode 3, but I just want to put this little feather in your cap. So when I hear you say that, and I agree with what you're saying about, you know, the posterity and all of that good stuff, but then here's what I would just throw out on the table is, could it have been that the founding fathers, not so much meaning to... tie the idealism of America to Christianity, but perhaps tie the idealism of America into American values. And what I mean by that is this, because you mentioned, if we all can't agree at that time, like you said, you had the Quakers, you had the Puritans, you had the Catholics, you had the Protestants, the Anglicans. So if they all couldn't agree on how to worship the God of Israel and the Christian God and divinity, then maybe it could have been like, okay, let's stay away from that hot button issue, but let's come up with a formation that we all could agree on. Maybe it's not necessarily secularism, maybe it's not necessarily Christianity, but maybe it's creating in its own ideology of Americanism, American values. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. No.
Thank you, very honestly. Thank you.
The myth is diversity makes things better. Okay, that's the myth, that diversity or this Americanism will somehow make things better. And as I said before, what this country was built upon, or the greatness of Western civilization, was a specific type of superego. Okay? Now, if your superego rises up with the superego of, say, the founders or the great leaders of Western civilization, those folks can have a problem with it because it's leading towards the same thing. Okay? Leading towards the same thing. Ultimately, leading you back to God. Okay? But it would lead you to great things. It would lead you to how our laws are written. You can't self-govern yourself. It's just you can't self-govern yourself without the absolute standard of morality, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But no, diversity sounds good, you know, it certainly gives you choice, but it doesn't necessarily make things better. That's the takeaway message here. Certainly, could be, say, what they're saying, if you are, say, Hispanic, Black, or Asian, and you have the same superego that the founders have, that is, love of God, love of country, love of neighbor, then the country will prosper, because you're on the same track. Remember, we were saying earlier about Jesus, of the political ideology, philosophy, he would believe more into fascism. He would reject communism. He would reject socialism. He would reject capitalism. He would go along with fascism and folks would be like, goodness, that sounds ridiculous because everybody here now.
Well, they have to listen to episode 1 for you to break that down, which I think you did a beautiful job on explaining that. But go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, so everybody, you know, is against anything fascist, but not understanding that fascism basically means cohesiveness and same single-mindedness towards the common goal. That's basically what a fascist is, okay? So yes, you could be of a diverse racial background, but how they would, for you to be part of their prosperity, you worship Jesus. If you care if you're a Catholic or a Protestant, you worship Jesus, you love this country, you love your neighbor, and then we're good to go, okay? But if you're doing something contrary to that, then you're going to disrupt the superego, okay? If, for instance, you believe, like, well, I don't believe Jesus exists, because you're having a problem now. Now you start to affect people.
Now, Robert, listen. Listen, I'm getting a red flag. Oh, my goodness. Okay, look, let's stop it right there, because what I wanted to come back to, and we will get deeper into this in episode 3. What I wanted to, you touched on immigration. And as we know, that is really a pressure cooker, and that's happening right now. I mean, literally right now. Our government is in part shut down because we're waiting on to see if we're going to get the money for the wall or not. So immigration is the hot button topic right now. But you also dealt with about the police no longer being a respected authority figure. You're dealing with that also in the cultural wars. So on our next episode, I want us to kind of delve more into immigration, delve more into law enforcement, because I think those two right now are two of the more weightier issues that we're dealing with. So Robert, I'm going to stop right there. Let our audience know where they can find your book, Riddle of Oz.
Yeah, that it could be found at Barnes & Noble website, Amazon website. Just type in Robert St. Thomas, Riddle of Oz, and you can website to pop up, and you know, the search engine will take you right to where the book is. It should be available right after Christmas if it's not available now. I know they were converting it to ebook. You can try it. It should be available for order. You can pre-order it. But as far as the actual hard copies in your hands, that might be maybe 2 weeks down the road. But they're available for pre-order right now.
Awesome. Robert, thank you so much for your time. And let me thank my audience. Guys, thank you so very much for listening to Bold Talk Radio. I'm your host, Pat Williams. And until next time, I'll see you.